We continue now with the book, My Spiritual Exercises, and the chapter on the examination of conscience, a suggested method of making the particular examination. St. Ignatius gives two counsels on the particular examination. Firstly, he says that on rising in the morning we should recall the subject of the particular examination and should renew our resolution. Secondly, he tells us that when we notice a fault against the subject of our examination, we should put our hand on our heart. This act will remind us of our failure and of our resolution to do better. If, however, we discover that this external action is attracting the notice of others, we should drop it or substitute for it one less noticeable. As already remarked, the spiritual profit of our particular examination presupposes a desire to be better, in other words, to be more pleasing to God. This is the reason of the petition on rising in the morning and at the beginning of the time devoted to the particular examination. Granted this, a knowledge of the frequency of the defect makes our desire to correct ourselves become more earnest, because we see a definite and serious work we have to do in order to become more pleasing to God. From this last point, it is easy to realize why many examinations of conscience have little or no result. The desire to be more pleasing to God is not there. We must often ask for this desire. A note on marking. St. Ignatius advises us to mark down in a book the number of times we failed each day, or the number of acts of virtue that we've made. This gives a character of business and seriousness to our efforts. Accounts are kept in every business. They do not directly increase the profit, but they tell us how we stand. They tell us in what department the loss has come. Something similar may be said of the marking of our particular examination. It gives a character of seriousness to our efforts and is an excellent help where its use is practicable. This method is eminently suited to St. Ignatius's own system, for there is a facility in marking when the examination is made in one's own room, as the Jesuits make it. But marking is difficult when the examination is in common. Some vary the method a little. Instead of marking the faults at the exercise itself, they do so as they occur. To achieve this end, they use little strings of movable beads. They slide one along each time they notice a fault. St. Teresa of the Child Jesus learned this method in her early years, but she used it not to mark her faults, but to count her little acts of mortification. Let us try to make a good examination of conscience in order that thus we may be drawn nearer to God. If a system of marking suits us, let us use it. If it does not, then it's best left aside. What is important is the result, not the method. The subject for particular examination. One of the chief difficulties of the particular examination is the selection of a suitable subject. This exercise often fails because the subject of examination is not the one best suited to the state of our soul. At each retreat, we should examine diligently whether the subject we have is really suited to us or not. If it is not, then we should seek to find a better one. In the selection of a subject, the following suggestions may be found useful. Do we go into any avoidable occasions of serious sin? If so, what are they, and are we making any effort to amend? This subject must be persevered in until we are in security. Next, we should take our avoidable exterior faults, such as the following. Do we speak of the faults of others? This is always a breach of charity in word, and can be really serious if these faults are unknown to the person to whom we're speaking. Are we critical, especially towards those in authority? No one does more harm to a religious community than the destructive critic. He spreads discontent on all sides and does absolutely no good to anyone. This is a fault which must be corrected. Tepidity is a fault we should all strive against. In the case of the tepid, there seems to be very little wrong, but in fact everything is wrong. The tepid, lukewarm soul is in the greatest danger. I would thou wert cold or hot, says Christ, but because thou art lukewarm and neither cold nor hot, I will begin to vomit thee out of my mouth. In religion, do we ignore our rule, especially in the small and constantly recurring details of our daily life? A religious without a rule is like a ship without a rudder and will be wrecked on the sea of life. Have we aversions or rivalries, and especially do we manifest them? Sometimes, for reasons we cannot fathom, feelings of aversion for some particular person arise habitually in us. We should never manifest this, but always show the greatest charity to that person until we have conquered the aversion. As for rivalries, why should we have them? If another has greater gifts than we have, are they not God-given? Must they not be used for God? Why should they be a source of rivalry? Are we irritable? Is it outwardly manifested? The actual feeling of irritability is often entirely interior, but its manifestation is not, and is something that can be mastered. Are we unpunctual? Have we the vice of always being late? Do we stop our work promptly when the signal goes for something else? Do we follow the example of St. Teresa of Lisieux, who used to put down her pen in the middle of a word? Are we slovenly in our person and dress, in the way we keep our room or our desk, or in the manner in which we do our work? Is our manner morose or unsociable? Are we bad community men or women? Are we habitually using strong and bitter language? Are we always complaining? The supernaturally minded person can see the brighter side of things. To them that love God, all things work together unto good. Are we indolent? Especially is there slothfulness in rising. This is a serious fault. Are we lovers of self-gratification at our meals? Are we lovers of our own comfort? Do we like to be well clothed and well housed? Do we want to surround ourselves with little conveniences that destroy in us the spirit of Christian poverty? Are we oversensitive, making every little oversight or thoughtlessness on the part of our neighbor an insult or an offense? Are we stubborn? Do we always want to do things in our own way and refuse to listen to prudent and experienced advice? Are we rigid and unbending? Christian charity requires give and take. Are we characterized by levity of mind? Some do not seem to grasp the fundamental issues at stake in the religious life, or to realize what a tragedy an unbalanced religious is. On the other hand, are we excessively serious? One meets some who think they must wear a long face always, never give way to laughter, or never enjoy the reasonable relaxations permitted by rule. Usually, though not always, such seriousness is skin deep and hides beneath it a shallow character. Have we an inordinate love of flattery? Do we love to hear ourselves praised and provoke others to praise us? If we seek the praise of men, we have our reward here below. We are working for self and not for God, and so shall not lay up treasure in heaven. Inordinate affections must be guarded against at all costs. Saints sometimes have a real spiritual affection for one another. They love to converse one with another about the things of God. Such an affection is good and praiseworthy. For religious, however, the more human affections, in other words, when one for no apparent reason wants to be in the presence of another and is unhappy in his absence, must be guarded against. It is a danger to chastity, especially when there is diversity of age or of sex. We should be anxious to be perfect, but we must be sure of the motive of our zeal. We should wish to be perfect because that is what God wishes for us. But when we seek for perfection merely as a personal excellence, in order that we may be better than others, then our zeal is a concealed form of pride. The devil sets his subtle snare, even for souls far advanced along the spiritual way. Irritation against wrongdoing is also a fault which attacks souls far advanced in the spiritual life. They are apt to expect too much from others. They do not realize that others do not get as great graces as themselves. In a spirit of humility, they should recognize that they too can fall, and that but for God's grace they would be as bad as others. They should, of course, strive to correct wrongdoing. To be irritated by it, however, will do no good and may do much harm. And lastly, when we see that our spiritual work for souls is a failure, we're apt to get discouraged and to give up. Once again, if our work were done for self, we would have reason for desisting. But if it's really done for God, failure need not discourage us. Let us learn a lesson from the great triumph of failure on Calvary. When we see this large array of possible subjects for particular examination, we realize the difficulty of choosing a subject. The next section will give us some help in overcoming this difficulty. It may happen also that as a director of souls, we should be asked to help others to choose a suitable subject. In giving this help, account should be taken of the advance already made by the soul in the interior life. The following table is constructed on this basis. The sections correspond roughly to the degrees of the spiritual life. As many of the faults enumerated in this second list have been fully treated already, we'll merely give a list of the faults and afterwards give fuller treatment of some of them. The order of subjects for particular examination, according to the progress of a soul in perfection: sloth, sensuality, carelessness of rule, habit of criticism, tepidity. Second, self-seeking, inordinate affection or aversions, want of kindness, zeal for our personal perfection from a wrong motive, such as vanity. Third, want of sincerity, irritation against wrongdoing, weakness in what concerns our Lord's interests, and resistance to failure in the work we do for souls. How to select a subject. As the selection of a proper subject for particular examination is a very difficult matter, we should use every help that will enable us to make a proper choice. Four classes of persons can be of help to us in the choosing of a subject. Firstly, we may ask a friend to select a subject. But unless he's a friend of long standing, who knows us intimately, and who can afford to be candid without fear of offense, we will find him rather unwilling to speak on the matter at all, or if he does speak, it'll be with such reserve as to be of no use. But a friend may often, in passing conversation, and without adverting to it, indicate a suitable subject for us. Faults that we often do not even suspect are so evident to others that they take it for granted we're well aware of them, and so they speak about them quite ordinarily in conversation. An enemy, however, is often much more useful in the indication of a subject. Of course, we should have no permanent enemies, but passing coldnesses sometimes arise owing to human weakness. And sometimes when these enmities occur, we're told some home truths about ourselves, especially if the person who's annoyed with us becomes a little angry. In our cooler moments, we can reflect with profit on the knowledge he thus imparts. A superior, too, is often very useful in indicating a subject when he corrects us or finds it necessary to reprimand us. It is to our confessor director, however, that we should especially turn for advice on this matter, and all the more so if we are well known to him both in and outside of confession. In this case, we should give him permission and ask him to use all his knowledge of us when advising us. Sometimes, when we're placed in exceptional circumstances, faults come to light that we did not even suspect. Thus, for example, although we do very well during the ordinary working year, when full religious discipline helps us along, we find ourselves falling often during holidays, when we're away from the community, or when the vacation regulation allows us greater latitude. Thus, various types of persons and circumstances can help us to discover our predominant faults, and in this way, to choose a subject for a particular examination. We have to remember, however, that it is we ourselves who must make a final choice. Just as no one else can actually save our souls for us, nor eradicate our faults, though others can help us a lot in these things, so also no one but ourselves can make a final and satisfactory choice of the subject of our particular examination. When selecting a subject, we should make it very definite and limited. The more definite and limited it is, the more precise will be our attack, and with God's blessing, the more rapid our victory. Thus, for example, if our subject is charity, we should restrict it to charity in word or charity in act. The whole scope of the virtue of charity would be too wide a field of action. We should have to be too constantly on the alert. We would tire too soon and achieve nothing. By attempting little, we gain much. By attempting all, we would gain nothing. It is important to correct first those venial sins that occur most frequently because of the danger of forming a habit if they're allowed to continue, of allowing an affection to grow up within us. These, when allowed to continue unchecked, make correction more difficult later on. Resist at first, says the imitation, lest the evil gather strength by long delay. Even internal faults may be made the subject of particular examination. They're more difficult to manage, however, than external faults, and are usually best eradicated by the cultivation of the opposite virtue. We shall discuss how to use the particular examination for this purpose. So far, we've spoken of the particular examination only as an instrument for the eradication of vices. But we can make use of it for the acquisition of virtue, and we should do so. A garden is not made perfect by weeding. We must also plant flowers. Our sanctification must always have a double aspect. We must not merely strive to die to sin, we must also strive to live for God. Acquiring virtue prepares us for future temptations. We have not temptations at present because there are no circumstances that excite our passions. These, however, are only asleep, and when occasion comes, will awake within us with unexpected strength. We should prepare against the evil day. It would be more accurate to speak of acquiring facility in virtue. Virtue itself is infused into our souls with sanctifying grace. The facility, however, for performing acts of virtue comes only through repetition of acts. The use of the particular examination to develop facility in virtue may be called the positive method of using it. The more we advance in the spiritual life, the greater will be the tendency to use it in this way. But in fact, it can be so used from the beginning. And even when we're eradicating a fault, we often do so successfully only by cultivating the opposite virtue. To use the particular examination to develop facility in virtue, we may proceed as follows. Determine a number of good acts of a definite kind that we propose to do each day, so many in the morning and so many in the evening. Examine and see if we perform these. Resolve to continue next day. Ask God for grace to keep this resolution. An excellent subject on which to use this method is the habit of frequently raising the heart to God during the day. Another subject to which we can apply this positive method is the habit of seeing God's hand in all the troubles, vexations, annoyances, disappointments, and even in the failures of our best efforts, and accepting all these from His kind hands as the daily cross which He wishes us to bear. A further subject is the habit of soul, which keeps us in docility before God, in tranquil abandonment to His will, with childlike trust, ready to be spent in doing that will once we know what God desires. We may determine the virtue by the faults we remark in ourselves. We can resolve to elicit a definite number of acts of the opposite virtue and examine how far we fall short. For example, against vanity, propose to elicit so many acts referring all to the glory of God. Against want of cheerfulness, propose to make acts of joy and gratitude for the sacraments and other blessings received. Against interior murmuring, make acts of acknowledgement that the hand of God is in all things. Against impatience, make a deliberate interior act of sweet acceptance of God's will, an act of patience, each time that impatience makes itself felt, an act contrary to our feeling. From the above, we can see that the positive method of using the particular examination, in other words, on a virtue, is easy and very effective. This is especially so in the case of those who have eradicated the most prominent external faults. Hence, as remarked before, it is of more avail as we advance in the spiritual life. We should not, however, give up completely the negative method of examination. If our will is exercised, all our faults will be gradually corrected. But it is well to examine ourselves carefully on sin from time to time, lest we deceive ourselves and permit serious faults to become habitual. Now, we should keep well in mind the following. Our particular examination should not be a mere consideration of the past. It should constantly bear on the future. The consideration of the past has its importance on account of the future. Our particular examination should strengthen the union of our will with God's will. We consider what is evil in us in order that we may make a new effort towards the supreme good. The object of the examination is to direct and intensify our endeavor. We must always be faithful to the practice of the particular examination. In the first place, it's a matter of rule, and the code of canon law binds those who are religious to fidelity to the spiritual exercises prescribed by rule. Canon 595 says, "Let superiors take care that all religious devote themselves each year to the spiritual exercises of a retreat, that those not legitimately impeded be present at Mass each day, that they devote themselves to mental prayer, and that they be zealous in fulfilling the other exercises of piety prescribed by the rules and constitutions." Among these latter, we find the exercises of the general and particular examinations. But let the fundamental motive for our fidelity to the particular examination be to make ourselves pleasing to God and to purify ourselves from self-seeking so that He may find in us no obstacles to His merciful designs for our sanctification. Examination before confession. The obligation to confess all mortal sins brings with it the obligation of taking the means to find out if we have committed a mortal sin since our last confession. This is to be found out by an examination of conscience made with ordinary, reasonable diligence. For those who confess every week and are honestly trying to serve God, an examination of conscience is not usually absolutely necessary, because if mortal sin were committed, it could hardly escape the memory. It is, however, most desirable. It should be kept in mind that the examination of conscience is only part of our preparation for confession. The most important part is the consideration we make to excite ourselves to sincere contrition and firm resolution. In examining our conscience before confession, we should look especially for the following kinds of sin and direct our contrition and resolutions accordingly. Venial sins, which are due to a permanent affection for sin, in other words, faults which are not the offense of the moment, but indicate a permanent wrong direction of the will. Examples are an attachment to earthly things, the keeping of things by religious without the necessary permission, a resentment entertained for a few hours, an inordinate affection given into for some time, a disposition to seek ourselves in our work, to seek our personal success. Venial sins for which we have not a permanent affection, but which, nevertheless, are often repeated. The repetition tends to form or intensify a habit, and a habit is a source of temptation. For example, the habit of criticizing. Venial sins that are very deliberate, although isolated. Some deliberation is found in every sin, and this deliberation may have innumerable degrees. Where there is little deliberation, sins are spoken of as indeliberate. The word is somewhat inaccurate. These sins committed with slight deliberation will always be present. We should, however, strive to diminish their number. Sins committed with full deliberation are always very hateful. They should be confessed with great care. These fully deliberate sins can be eliminated from our life through God's grace. On this matter, St. Teresa writes, "You must also be extremely vigilant about venial faults. I am speaking of misdeeds that are committed with full consent and which are deliberate, for who does not constantly lapse into inadvertent errors? But there is one inadvertency which is very deliberate and another so sudden that to commit sin and know it seem one and the same thing, and we hardly realize what we are about, although yet to a certain extent we are aware of it. But from willingly committing any sin, however small, may God deliver us." In this examination, as in all others, while we strive to attain to great purity of soul, we must avoid scrupulosity. A delicate conscience is one which shrinks from the least sin. All the saints had delicate consciences. It's a good state of the will. A scrupulous conscience, on the other hand, is one which fears sin when there is no reason, and imagines mortal sin when there is only venial sin. It is a defect in the judgment. We must cultivate delicacy of conscience, not scrupulosity. Retreat examination. This examination of conscience may profitably be made at any time, but since it is particularly suitable during retreat, we call it for convenience the retreat examination. It deals with our general outlook and dispositions. It should give us the answer to such questions as the following. What principles govern our life? Is our life governed by likes or dislikes? Or rather, is it governed by what God likes or dislikes, or by what we like or dislike? In a word, is God's will or our own will the governing principle of our life? St. Ignatius says a retreat is a series of exercises to enable a man to conquer himself and regulate his life without being biased by any inordinate like or dislike. The retreat examination is a help to this great work. It will safeguard us from the terrible discovery at death that our life has been governed by wrong principles. The examination in retreat should therefore be directed to the sources of evil which are in us rather than to our sins. It should regard our present state rather than our past. In a word, the retreat examination should rectify our dispositions with regard to the present and the future. In the annual examination outlined by St. Francis de Sales for the time of retreat, we find that 7 times consecutively the questions he proposes have regard not to the past, but to the present dispositions of the soul. 7 times he asks, "What is the attitude of your heart towards?" He has the present and the future more in view than the past. It is manifest, therefore, that in time of retreat, our examination of conscience should deal with our dispositions rather than with individual acts. Our present spiritual state is what we seek to know. Now we can make this examination with great profit if we consider the virtues we should have practiced rather than the vices we have fostered. The Church supplies a question test. But to make our examination in this way, we need help. We need advice so as to pay attention to what is most important. Where will we get the authority on which to rely in this matter? The church comes to our aid. She gives us an official examination of conscience to which we can refer with absolute confidence. She's drawn up a set of questions to be given to the witnesses in the court for the beatification or canonization of her children. The life of the person who is proposed for beatification must pass this examination. Here we have an official test of sanctity, the church's test. We have a practical picture of sanctity. We must not say, "I am only an ordinary Christian. Beatification is not for me. This examination will be above me." The answer is obvious. Only saints are admitted to heaven, and we must strive to be saints if we want to enter. Hence, it's good to have a clear and practical idea of the sanctity we must aim at. The same commandments are for all of us. The one way to heaven must be trodden by all. Before considering this official test of sanctity, we should note the following. The fundamental question which we seek to answer by examining our conscience is this: are we living as we should the life of intimate friendship with God, to which we are all raised by sanctifying grace? Are we doing the good that is implied in living this life of intimate friendship with God? Here is the general object of our examination of conscience. Now, it should be noticed that from this point of view, the examination will be on positive questions rather than on negative. It will regard virtue rather than vice. Hence, the standard of examination should be a picture of goodness, a picture of a virtuous life. Consider further that we cooperate with the designs of God's goodness in our regard by conforming our will with the divine will. "He that doeth the will of my Father who is in heaven, he shall enter into the kingdom of heaven." This union of our will with the divine will implies the keeping of the commandments, which in turn implies the practice of the virtues. Hence we see that it is well to study the virtues so as to find wherein we failed, and then school ourselves to walk steadfastly in the way of God's commandments for the future. It is a real inspiration to examine our conscience from the point of view of what we should have been, to consider the virtues we have not practiced, rather than the vices we have actually indulged in. As we've said, the questions asked of the witnesses in the examination on the virtues are determined by the church. They give her official test of Christian perfection. They have an authority above that of any spiritual writer. For our consolation, let us note that they represent Christian perfection as something that we all can aspire to. The questions follow the order of the four cardinal virtues and the three theological virtues. They therefore treat of the virtues in the following order: temperance, fortitude, justice, prudence, and faith, hope, and charity to man and to God. We shall submit a selection of these questions. It would be most advisable to read the questions on one virtue at a time and examine ourselves on them before passing on to another virtue. If we allow our memory to dwell often on them, they will provide it with a concrete and vivid picture of the Christian standard for that virtue. The test on the moral virtues. Temperance. Were denial of his own will and internal mortification characteristics of the servant of God? Did he restrain the motions of anger? Did he bear persecution with meekness and patience? Was he unduly tenacious of his own opinion? Was he sparing in the use of food and drink? Did he observe the fast of the church? Did he indulge in long hours of sleep? Was his bed comfortable or uncomfortable? Was he anxious to be well clothed and well housed? Did he neglect the comforts of life? Did he mortify the senses? Did he love silence and solitude? Was he modest in his demeanor? On fortitude, Was he strong and faithful in the duties of his office, indefatigable in work, patient in persecution, injury, calumny, in trouble of mind? Has he borne all these in a cheerful spirit? Was he always himself not elated by prosperity or depressed by adversity? Did he despise the honors, riches, and pleasures of the world? Did he constantly defend the rights of the church and restrain the licentiousness of wicked men? On justice, was he affable towards others? Was he subject to his parents and superiors? Did he show himself grateful for favors received and strive to excite gratitude in others? Did he discharge with justice the office committed to him, avoiding all acceptance of persons? Did he so temper the severity of justice with benignity that no one could ever have just cause of complaint against him? Did he render unto God due honor and obedience? Did he pay veneration to the saints? Did he accept the decrees of the supreme pontiffs with proper respect and reverence? And was he exact in the observance of the sacred rites and ceremonies of the church? Did he endeavor to promote the worship of God? Did he respect the rights of all and give them what was due to them? Did he hate usury and fraud of every kind? On prudence, did he direct all his actions to the attainment of eternal glory as his last end and select the necessary and useful means? Did he love simplicity, and was he sincere and true in thought and word? And did he hate all duplicity and falsehood? Did he seek the advice of prudent men and act on it? Were all his acts good, and did he first invoke divine aid for their due performance? Had he a deep hatred of idleness as the source of vice, and did he love meditation and solitude? Now the test on the theological virtues, on faith. Did he often return thanks to God that he was born in the bosom of the Catholic Church and pray that all would be brought within her fold? Did he burn with the desire of propagating the faith? Did he teach the truths of Christianity to the faithful, and did he teach the catechism? Did he rejoice when some erring soul was converted to the Catholic faith? Was he mournful when the church suffered loss or persecution? Was the decoration of the house of God dear to him, and the observance of the sacred ceremonies? Did he love devotion to the Blessed Virgin, and endeavor to propagate it, and how? Did he pray long and frequently before the Blessed Sacrament? Did he show a tender devotion to the Passion of Jesus Christ? Did he often meditate on this mystery? With what fervor and piety? And did he strive to enkindle this devotion in others? Did he burn with the desire of shedding his blood for the truths of the faith? Did he venerate the sacred scriptures and the writings of the holy fathers? Did he obey the laws of the church and the commands of his superiors? Did he show honor to the sovereign pontiff and all the ministers of God? Did he desire to gain indulgences? Did he hate all bad books and everything opposed to the faith? Did he frequently approach the sacraments of penance and the Blessed Eucharist? On hope, did he firmly hope for salvation from the merits of Christ our Lord? Did he despise the things of the world, and how did he show his contempt? In trying circumstances, did he place his trust in God alone and have recourse to prayer? Did he show his hope in God by ardent and pious exclamations? And did he raise up others to confidence in God? Did he show a desire by word and work to suffer for eternal glory? And did he rejoice at the near approach of death as the beginning of true life? With what confidence did he practice good works? Did he strive to excite this confidence in others? In adversity, was he resigned to the goodness of God and the decrees of his providence? Did he direct his desires and all his actions to God as his last end? Did he bear cheerfully adversity and persecution, and if a religious, the austerity of the religious life and the duties of his ministry? Did he desire, with St. Paul, to be dissolved and be with Christ? And did he bear infirmity and suffering with a joyous spirit? On charity to our neighbor, did he pray for the conversion of sinners? What were his relations towards his enemies? Did he forgive them, receive them meekly, and pray for them? Did he prevent discord? Had he at heart the good name of others? With what frequency and fervor did he offer up prayers for the souls of the deceased? On temporal charity, did he comfort the afflicted? Did he excuse the defects of his neighbors? What was his attitude towards the sick? Did he love the poor, help them according to his ability, and strive to induce others to assist them? Did he instruct the ignorant and give counsel to those in doubt? Did he admonish sinners, restore peace and concord amongst the quarrelsome? Did he devote himself to the spiritual and physical well-being of the sick? We will continue with my spiritual exercises and the examination of conscience on tape number 6, the spiritual exercises of Reverend John Kearney, CSSP.